Hi, this is Katie Day and welcome to Creating Ripples, the program that showcases inspirational women across the globe. Sometimes it can be the small acts and achievements that can create the biggest ripples. We're here to share some amazing stories. They will make you laugh. Sometimes they may make you cry. They will always inspire you. Today, it is my absolute pleasure to be interviewing the Right Honourable Patricia Hewitt. Patricia is chair of the UK India Business Council that works with the British government to promote bilateral trade between the UK and India. Patricia had a long and distinguished career in politics and government, including as the longest serving Secretary of State for Trade and Industry in the last 50 years. In that role, she made India her top international priority, believing, as she said in 2002, that India was rapidly becoming the world's most exciting, knowledge-driven economy. She also served in Tony Blair's government as Cabinet Minister for Women from 2001 to 2005 and Secretary of State for Health from 2005 to 2007. Born in Australia, Patricia took her undergraduate degree at Cambridge University and has been awarded an MA by both Cambridge and Oxford. She is an honorary associate of Newnham College, Cambridge, and an honorary doctor of De Montfort University and an honorary fellow of the London Business School. For the last 6 years, Patricia has been an active supporter of Katha, a profit for all social enterprise in India that is transforming the lives of children and their families in Delhi's slums. She chairs the donor consortium established by the British Asian Trust, one of the Prince of Wales Trusts, to support Katha's work. In October 2014, Patricia was selected by the British government to receive the first Dadabhai Nauroji Award to recognise her contribution to economic ties between the UK and India. Although her efforts to learn Hindi have not been very successful, she wowed the vibrant Gujarat summit in January 2013 with her speech in Gujarati. Thank you, Patricia, so much for giving up your time to be interviewed. It really is such a pleasure. We've met a few times before. You have such an amazing story in history.
Well, thank you, Katie. It's just lovely to be with you.
So tell us a bit more about India and how that link with India started and where that passion for the country came from.
Well, I'm Australian by origin. I always say I'm a fourth generation Aussie Sheila, like something out of Neighbours. So I feel, I guess, a natural affinity with the Asia Pacific region. That's kind of where my roots are. Mm. But when I was, 18, I left Canberra, Australia's capital where I grew up, and I came to Cambridge as a student. My grandmother had been one of the early women students
was
there.
She?
Yes.
Wow.
She went to Cambridge in the early 1900s when women were allowed to study at Cambridge, but they weren't allowed to take a degree.
Good grief.
So she took her exams and, of course, passed them, but they wouldn't give her a degree. And
wow.
Trinity College Dublin, which was well ahead of Cambridge in those days, they gave her and all the other women who'd passed their exams a degree from Trinity College Dublin.
Fantastic.
So I remember the story from my grandmother. After the war, after 1945, she finally got a letter from Cambridge University saying, "We've now decided to give degrees to women. So we're very happy to present you with yours."
Well, that's good of them.
Bless her, exactly. Bless her cotton socks. She wrote back and said, "Trinity College Dublin was there for me when I needed them. And I'm very proud to have a degree that, says MA brackets TCD. And I don't want my Cambridge degree now.
Good
You're too
her.
Late.
Good
Isn't that wonderful?
You're quite
very
right,
feisty,
too.
Very feisty woman, my grandmother. She was great. So I kind of followed in her footsteps and came to Cambridge as an undergraduate to study English literature. So I get to Newnham and I discovered that my sort of head of the department for English literature was an Indian woman, wonderful woman called Sita. Sita Narasimhan. And this being Cambridge, we would sit on the floor, this is late 1960s, freezing cold in the middle of Cambridge winter, you know, winds from Siberia and all that, not much heating. Yeah. And we'd be sitting there studying medieval carols, because that's what you did in the first term of Cambridge English in those days. And Sita would take a deep breath and say, now, in Sanskrit literature. And then she would just go off into this other world.
Oh my gosh.
And I fell in love with the whole idea of India.
Yeah.
And I think what a lot of people say is, if you're English speaking from the West, then India is probably the part of Asia or South Asia that is exotic but somehow familiar.
Mm-hmm.
And because you have the English mm-hmm. language in common, at least for so many Indians, it somehow makes it easier to approach than a country where, you know, you haven't got the language, you haven't got any sort of point of entry.
It's an interesting country, isn't it? There is sort of a magnetic pull from the UK to India. And having just come back from Mumbai, amazed of how much of it looks like London.
It's extraordinary.
You've got to have double-decker buses.
Yes,
you have the Houses of Parliament and Big Ben, otherwise known as BT Station. It's just, oh, hello, that looks familiar.
Yep. And it's really true around most of India.
Yeah.
I mean, if you go to Calcutta, you've got the old Raj buildings, the buildings from the British Empire. I mean, falling down, most of them, but the heritage potential there is extraordinary. Of course, Delhi, where I was just a week or two ago, I was in New Delhi, which was designed by Lutyens, one of the great sort of English architects and landscape gardeners. And it's absolutely beautiful, New Delhi. It's designed around huge roundabouts, big gracious avenues. It was built as an imperial capital, so you have the great long open avenue with grass and trees and flowers on each side,
beautiful.
Going up to the parliament and the administrative blocks, down the other end, the Gateway of India. That is now where India has its great sort of Independence Day and Republic Day celebrations, and you see the Camel Corps, for instance. I've never actually seen them on the day, it's still on the to-do list, but I've seen them rehearsing for January the 26th, which is India Day. And it is, again, exotic, extraordinary.
It is.
Just extraordinary. There is a... There's India has colour and creativity and chaos and noise and smell and so many different communities, religions, languages, belief systems. I mean, it's extraordinary.
It is the most, it tests you on every level, doesn't it?
It does. And, you know, it's one of the youngest countries in the world, in the sense half its population is under 25, but it's one of the most ancient civilizations in the world. And so, goodness me, you feel, you know, you're just beginning to understand something, and then of course you discover how little you really know.
Absolutely. It's vibrant, it's exciting. Well, we mentioned when we were in India that the British introduced bureaucracy to the country and the Indians have fine-tuned it.
Absolutely.
So you have to let go of control when you're in that country, because it's just not going to work.
Absolutely. And some of my Indian friends say to me, you know, Indians have a very different view of time.
Oh boy.
Yep. So there's kind of linear time, Western time, and then there's Indian time, which really goes in circles. And of course, I used to be a member of parliament in Leicester, in West Leicester. And Leicester is really the most Indian city in Britain. It's what we call the first majority minority city, where the majority of the population will very soon be Asian or Black British.
Oh my God, more than Bradford.
Oh yes.
Oh my gosh.
Yes, it's very interesting.
How interesting.
It's very diverse. And indeed, amongst young people, it's already majority mm. minority. And I gradually found, you know, with my Indian friends and constituents, I needed to let them know at the beginning of the afternoon or the meeting, whatever it was, either I'm on Indian time, it's fine, it can take as long as we like, or today I'm on English time. I've got 1 hour, I'm really sorry, but then I've got a whole string of appointments and I've got to go. And I found that was quite a useful device, really.
It is. It's fascinating. When I was there, I wondered how the country works, but somehow it does. It all happens, but I have no idea how it happens, but it just all happens. It teaches me a lot of lessons. It teaches me to let go of control. It yes. teaches me to be more organic and more allowing and more trusting.
Yes.
Rather than trying to think I know all the answers. Because if you go to India thinking you know all the answers, you're going to fall flat on your face very, very quickly. Because you realize you have no answers at all to anything. Yes. So you have to, it really tests, as a reformed control freak, it really tests me to go, okay, I'm leaving the hotel. I think I know what's happening today, but actually I have no idea at all, and that's fine.
Indeed. And it will happen.
It will happen.
If it's meant to happen. Yeah. And if it doesn't happen today, then it'll probably happen tomorrow. And if it doesn't happen on this visit,
that's
then
okay.
with a bit of luck, it'll visit.
Yeah,
happen next visit.
And
yes, I agree. I think being very relaxed about that, taking the time and perhaps also what you're reflecting. I mean, one of the many extraordinary things about India is that depth of spiritual tradition. And I find so many of my Indian friends, they meditate,
yeah.
they do yoga, they have a sense of tapping into themselves.
Very much.
But also tapping into, I mean, a tradition that goes back many thousands of years of, you know, deep wisdom, really, and collective wisdom.
I found that fascinating in business meetings, of how much spirituality came up in business meetings. Of something that you just
yes.
don't get in the UK, because no. it's far too scary for businessmen to talk about meditation. I mean, I'm not going, that's far too scary. But in India, the businessmen were talking about the spiritual side of their life and about bringing
yes.
their whole being
yes.
to the world of work in
yes.
a way that, so you have conversations on a much deeper level there, I think.
I think that's right. And I think that's one of the reasons why the best Indian businesses are those that really see themselves creating wealth for the entire community.
Mm.
And of course, you know, the family who own the business are also doing well, and hopefully the employees are doing well, the customers are doing well, everybody is doing well. But Tata,
yes.
I mean, the largest
yes.
you know, group of companies in India,
yeah.
which has huge investments
huge,
in the UK.
Huge.
Huge. I mean, you know, they own Jaguar Land Rover, which they're making the
yep.
most enormous success of, and of course exporting a lot to the US. It's really doing well. But they're very interesting because their founder absolutely saw Tata as almost belonging to the communities in which it operates.
Mm.
So, you know, he was practicing corporate social responsibility, I think, before most of our companies even started talking about it.
Completely. It's interesting because CSR now, of course, is quite a big thing in
yes.
India. They have to give 2% of their
yeah.
their profits to CSR. And it's really interesting having those CSR discussions with Indian companies, is that they view CSR as philanthropy. Because they kind of do the other stuff anyway. Because they have quite a
yes.
paternalistic way of running their companies, so they automatically look at the bigger picture anyway
yes.
of the impact of community, that really in the UK and possibly North America we're just kind of getting our head around that it's more than just a bottom line profit.
I think it's a mixed picture. I think there absolutely are Indian companies and Indian business families who take that approach. You'll already be putting probably well over the 2% into the corporate foundation, into the communities they're working in, all that sort of thing. I think there are others, some of them very well known, where if there is philanthropy, it's pretty skin deep.
Right.
And where really you have unbelievable wealth for the business family and an extraordinary indifference to the poverty all around.
That's
and equally
true.
I would say in Britain there are, you know, there are a number of companies who really do believe that they will do well by doing good, and if they're doing the right thing by their customers and their employees, well, you know, shareholders will benefit as well. And I think that's a good approach to business.
Yes. And it's the stark difference between the rich and the poor in India is something that I have never experienced in any other country in the world I've visited. And that's a real shock to the senses when you first experience it, isn't it?
Yeah. And I think it's one of the reasons why some people go to India for the first time and just hate it. Partly, in some cases, because they just find it too much of everything. But because the poverty and the violence that often goes with that is just so horrific. And I certainly hope I've not become desensitized to that. I don't think I have, but one of the things I decided to do as I became more involved in India was not just work with business and work with UK India Business Council promoting trade and business relationships, because I mean I do believe very strongly that's very good for jobs and growth in India, but also for jobs and growth in Britain. But I also could see a huge danger of just spending all my time in fairly comfortable surroundings, sometimes very comfortable surroundings, and staying in nice hotels and going to business meetings and so on and so forth. And I got very involved a long time ago with a wonderful charity, you mentioned it, called Katha.
Yeah.
And they are based, their school, which they call the Lab School, where they really keep developing and trying their teaching methods, that's based in Govindpuri, which is one of the biggest slums in Delhi.
Right.
So the first time I went there, you know, there were a couple of us in cars. Luckily, the drivers knew where to go. So, you know, we were driving through these mad, chaotic, noisy streets of Delhi. And we were actually on a big, big main road, you know, with shacks all the way down the side, and every shack had a tiny little business, and there were people selling things everywhere, and I mean,
amazing,
all of that in
amazing.
Delhi. And of course, cows wandering around the place. And then we turned off that, and almost immediately we were in this bumpy, dusty, chaotic, narrow little lane. I mean, there was just room for one car to get down and pedestrians to kind of scatter to each side. And down that lane, we kind of drove down there and we stopped. And on one side, there's this old brick building, which is the Katha School, has been for 27 years.
My gosh.
And it is extraordinary because all around it are these shacks made out of, you know, corrugated iron and bits of wood and cardboard and mud.
And the blue plastic tarpaulings.
Blue plastic tarpaulings, absolutely. God. People just, they make
incredible
homes out of anything. And so the children who come to the Katha school are living in these slums. Maybe their mother is working as a maid or a cleaner in a house for a better off family down the road, maybe. And in the school, you know, you go in through the gate, everything is painted. There are children's drawings and pictures and murals all over the walls. In every classroom, there are these wonderful teachers, almost entirely women,
right,
who are women from Govindpuri,
ah,
who've been trained in the Katha teaching methods.
Wonderful.
And Katha is the Hindi word for story.
Oh, is it?
And
how lovely.
Gita, who's a dear friend now, she founded it 27 years ago. She wanted to write novels for adults. Then she started thinking about writing children's books. Then she said to herself, what's the point of writing children's books when most children can't read?
Wow.
So she's an extraordinary woman. She said, right, I'm going to do something about this. We'll create Katha. She created a magazine, which, you know, is just wonderful. But as well as writing the books, she created a way of teaching reading that was all based on storytelling.
How wonderful.
But it's very disciplined. So it takes a child from having maybe 60 words that they know to having 600.
Gosh.
And then 6,000.
Yeah.
So that they can then go from the slum into the regular school. And now what Katha is doing is actually working with the regular schools, the government schools, where, you know, attendance is poor, the children don't learn much. It's a huge challenge. Most children in India are now enrolled in a primary school. The challenge now is to get them really learning.
Right.
So when I was with Katha a couple of weeks ago, Gita has now become the president of the organization. And a wonderful woman who's been there for years, who was running the school, Parvinda, she's taken over as the executive director.
Right.
So Parvinda and I sat together, and she was telling me about the I Love Reading program, which is now reaching out to nearly 90,000 children.
Oh my gosh.
In the government schools in Delhi and in the local communities.
Wonderful.
And what Katha has done is train, again, local women as reading mentors. They then go into the classrooms and into the schools. They work with the teachers to make learning fun, because Katha long ago discovered that it's story-based teaching doesn't just work for reading, it works for everything
works for
else
everything.
As well.
And for adults too.
And it works for adults.
We also like stories.
We do. And they've just had I Love Reading evaluated, and it's just extraordinary. I mean, children's attendance has gone from about 40% to nearly 90%.
Gosh.
You know, just amazing. And even within a year, the children are showing huge improvements, from about 20% to about 80% in actually being able to read and understand, you know, a story for their age group. So it's having a wonderful effect. And
incredible.
I've been supporting them personally, but I've also, they've now been adopted by the British Asian Trust, which is one of Prince Charles, the Prince of Wales charities. And so we've been mobilising a lot of donors around them to help them scale up.
I was going to ask you that question. I mean, surely the rest of India needs them. So,
well,
is it going to be replicated in other Tier 1 and Tier 2 cities?
What they're doing now is looking at exactly this. How do they scale up their impact? So they're already working in Rajasthan and in Gujarat, down towards closer to Mumbai. And they're partnering again with government schools and with other charities there. The government school program in Delhi is clearly having a big effect, and that will continue. But they're now going to partner with the Education Alliance, which is a larger NGO. And what will happen there, they'll become one of several charities working to take over government schools that are almost empty.
Gosh.
And they're empty because the parents, generally parents living on very low incomes, have taken their children out of the government school and put them into what's known as an affordable private school,
right,
just to get something a bit better for their children.
Right.
This thirst for education and the understanding that that's the way out of poverty.
And they really do get it, don't they?
Completely.
Really hits me is the respect that children have for education.
Yes.
I so wish we could get a bit more of that back here in the UK.
Well, I know. I mean, I see these children coming, you know, out of these tiny little slum houses that they are living in. And there they are, bright-eyed, wanting to learn, clean. Ironed, white shirt, smart blue skirt or trousers, everything. I mean, how their mothers, sometimes their fathers, but mainly their mothers, do it. It is
incredible.
Extraordinary. It's very humbling.
It is very humbling. And they are so delighted and so proud to have their school books under their arm and all be marching, these little, adorable little children walking hand in hand off to school. And really, you can see the excitement to learn.
Yes, absolutely.
It's
they
amazing.
Want it. And it's interesting. I mean, I've seen at the Qatar school, there's a wonderful computer lab there, which BT actually has supported from the outset, and British Telecom as well. And, you know, that was in response to the children and their parents saying, we want to learn about computing because that's how we'll get a good job. Of course, in India, it makes perfect sense
with
its, you know, amazing IT services business. So it is
incredible.
It's an extraordinary story, and it's part of what gives me and many others, you know, such huge optimism about India. Of course, there are things government needs to do, and the Narendra Modi government is doing a lot of those things, but ultimately it's this extraordinary energy and ambition of and aspiration of Indians themselves that will drive the growth and bring people out of poverty.
It really will. I was on the flight out, I was watching the film Suffragette.
Yes, I haven't seen it yet.
It's amazing. Amazing. And when I was out there training women, and so I was saying to them, you are 21st century suffragettes. And the look of excitement on their faces, I went, oh, yes, I suppose we are, aren't we? And you could see, you know, they have this drive and ambition and hunger and focus and determination that nothing is going to get in their way. And the challenges that they have, you know, some of the stories that were coming back, and these are from very well-educated women from good families, but the culture is so different. You know, they are, with women in business, probably where we were 20 years ago, 25 years ago, with the added cultural pressures. And interestingly, the abuse that they get usually comes from their mother-in-law for not being good wives, because they're not staying at home looking after their husband and actually looking after their mother-in-law.
Yes.
So, you know, they have all the pressures that we women in the West had a couple of decades ago, with the added cultural dimension thrown in for good measure. And it's huge what they have to go through.
Oh, it is enormous. And I mean, it's wonderful that you are doing this work with women in India, and, you know, and supporting them and telling them they're 21st century suffragettes is such a great way to describe it, because it's a very curious picture. I mean, India has got more women in charge of banks, for instance,
interesting,
than the UK and probably the US. So particularly for women who are already, you know, who are part of a business family and a family that is owning its own business, then of course the woman will be expected to contribute, she'll be there, she'll rise up, she'll have a senior position, she'll run another business, whatever. So at one level there are lots of opportunities, but those are for the elite women, as you were saying. But even they also can get those cultural pressures. And, you know, for women who are really the first first generation in their family to be working in an office, you know, who are one generation away from a village and subsistence farming, the pressure, the difficulties, I mean, just the transport, you know, and the fact that it can take you a couple of hours in the morning and a couple of hours in the evening to get to and from work, and the physical risks that women run.
Yeah.
And, you know, domestic violence and sexual harassment and rape are a challenge in every country and every culture. But there is, there is a degree of brutality about, you know, the rapes that are reported just every day in every newspaper in India that is unbelievably shocking. Mm. And I would say on issues around sexual violence, it reminds me very much of the early modern women's movement in Britain in the 70s, when we were naming domestic violence and demanding that it be taken seriously and not just treated as, well, of course, you know, a man has the right to beat his woman, it's just a domestic. So there's a big struggle going on there, and as you say, the sheer bravery of Indian women.
Yeah, it's quite phenomenal. Wonderful. Quite phenomenal. I had one woman is in her mid-50s, comes from a very good family, but is campaigning around violence against women generally within India. And she's had death threats, but it doesn't stop her. She keeps going, and they are fearless, these women. Yeah. Absolutely fearless. How do you see the work with UKIBC linking into that and making a difference, if it can make a difference?
I do believe that as the economy, as India develops, as its economy grows, as more people set up businesses, more people get education, more people get employment, that is going to be good for women as well as men. You know, the modern economy in India is creating opportunities that young Indians want, and they want very urgently. Mm. So, you know, one of the big challenges for the Indian government is whether they can actually get the economy growing fast enough to meet the aspirations of these, you know, tens and hundreds of millions of young Indians who went out to vote less than 2 years ago now to bring in Narendra Modi's government. And with development will come, I think, much greater opportunities, and along with that, greater equality.
Okay.
But it won't happen, you know, it won't happen automatically. No. These things always have to be fought for, which is why I think it is important for businesses and entrepreneurs who are investing in India from Britain or from the States, from wherever, are really attuned to issues of equality and diversity.
Yeah.
In a sense, the diversity issue is a very obvious one. If you're a British company investing and setting up operations in India, you have to be very sensitive to the extraordinary diversity of your Indian workforce and the cultural issues, you know, between those who are coming from Britain and, or indeed British expats who are living in India. But you also need to be very, very aware and take the trouble to understand what your women are going through. I remember it was the first time I went to India as a government minister.
Mm.
So I was in Bangalore and I went to Infosys, which at that point was still quite a new IT services company. And I was being shown around by one of its wonderful co-founders, Narayana Murthy. He told me the story of how he and I think his four or five fellow founders they'd basically borrowed their wives' dowries in order to set up the company.
Wow.
But in those days, the Infosys campus, which is a huge part of Bangalore, didn't have that many buildings on it. But in between the buildings, and it just looked like a modern university campus, there was acres and acres of grass and beautiful flower beds and trees and so on. And I commented on how gorgeous the gardens were, and he said, absolutely, we are determined to show that India can create a world-class company that is as good as anything you would find in California or wherever. So that was very significant. Mm. But what he also said was, you see the gardeners, they're all women, and he'd very deliberately gone out to the villages around, some of them at some distance from Bangalore, and he'd recruited village women to come and work at Infosys.
Gosh.
And he'd paid them a decent wage, he'd given them training, given them respect.
Wow.
He said it transformed their position in the village, because of course they became the highest earning person, or one of the highest earning people in the village.
Fantastic.
It was wonderful.
Yeah.
And we know from decades of development work that actually when you educate and invest in women, then you really begin to transform the community, because you transform the whole family.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, they're great role models for their children, for both their boys and their girls.
Yes.
Because it is changing that attitude of men towards women in India. And
yes.
It's a bit like turning around a tanker. It's not going to happen overnight, is it?
Well,
but it has to start.
Yeah. And there's a lot. It's interesting. I came across another very interesting charity that's working with Indian men to start tackling attitudes towards
Fantastic.
Women. Because it's very clear that particularly for men, Indian men who don't have good jobs and who've been brought up with a very traditional view of women, to see women generally from, a somewhat better off family or a different caste group, getting an education and getting a job, that is such a threat to them.
Mm-hmm.
And so you get, not from all men obviously, but you get from some men this very violent, very vicious male backlash.
Yeah.
So challenging that attitude, getting men working with other men to think
really
about
important.
And change those attitudes, that is absolutely critical. It needs to happen on a much bigger scale.
It does, it really does. What is your, we've got about 3 minutes, amazingly. I knew 40 minutes wasn't going to be long, I have to come back. What is your vision for UK India Business Council?
I want UK India Business Council to be the go-to organisation for any entrepreneur, business person, business professional who is doing business between India and the UK, between the UK and India. We're already the leading B2B, business-to-business network, but we really want to help catalyse more investment in both directions, more innovation in both directions. India has got, for instance, some wonderful healthcare companies that are figuring out how to provide world-class hospital care but at a fraction of the cost, by doing it smarter.
It's a growing market for India, isn't it?
It's critical. And frankly, we in the National Health Service, or indeed in the American healthcare system, we need that expertise, just as we need to be sharing with India, the expertise that the NHS has, for instance, in primary care and so on. So we have so much to learn from each other and to share with each other.
Yeah.
But it needs to be happening faster and on a much bigger scale even than it is today.
Really?
Yeah, look, trade between Britain and India, it's been growing, not as fast as either of us would like to see. The investment story is great. India is investing more in the United Kingdom than the whole of the rest of the European Union put together.
Right.
The UK actually invests more in India than any other G20 country, including the US. So, the investment relationship is enormous. There isn't as much trade as we would all like to see. And, there are a number of different reasons for that. But fundamentally, my view is that as India and Indians become better off and create more jobs and more businesses, what they will also do is buy more from Britain and other parts of the West. They will travel even more to Britain and other parts of the West. And that's good for our economy and our growth, just as it is for India's economy and India's growth.
It is. In a few words, where do you see India on the world stage in 5 years' time?
India is already growing faster than China.
Gosh.
So in 5 years, it's going to be, I'm sure, the fastest growing major economy in the world. It's the youngest economy in the world. It's increasingly becoming one of the most influential in terms of innovation, but also because of its regional position, the fact that it's an increasingly important strategic partner for the United States, as well as for Britain and a number of other countries. So even bigger, even more important than it is today.
Wow. Thank you, Patricia, so much. I can't believe we are at 41 minutes already. That feels like 4 seconds. If you're willing, I will have to come back and interview you again. So much more I wanted to talk to you about, but thank you so much.
Katie, thank you. It's been a pleasure.
This has been Katie Day with Creating Ripples. Listen in and be part of the revolution that is rocking the world. Women over 50 are the new future. We are awesome, fearless, fabulous, inspiring, passionate, courageous. In fact, we just rock.